From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Many people think science should help guide public policy debates. We'll chat with one Duke University professor who asks us to beware, though, of bad science. Some state lawmakers want to redraw election maps for judicial races across North Carolina. You'll hear highlights from a recent debate on the topic. You'll learn why a Charlotte woman has filed suit against state rules that block her from opening up a makeup school. And speaking of state rules, we'll learn about the latest roadblocks created by North Carolina's out-of-date Certificate of Need restrictions. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Just days from now, North Carolina lawmakers will return to Raleigh for another special legislative session. Now, this one is expected to last at least several days. So why are they coming back? What will they address? And what do these special sessions say about having a part-time legislature? Becky Gray is Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. She will be following the session very closely. She's here with a preview. Becky, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
There's a whole lot of different areas that they could be covering, but one at the top of the list is judicial districts. What do they want to do?
Well, we're hearing this. They're having some committees now. This got a lot of controversy during these past sessions. What this would do is it would redistrict the judicial districts across North Carolina. We've had a lot of focus on congressional redistricting, legislative redistricting. Now they're looking at judicial redistricting. It's a little bit of a different animal because judicial districts don't have to reflect one man, one vote. They just have to distribute the state's judicial resources in an equitable way so that every North Carolinian has access to the judicial system. A little bit controversial in that there was a map that was rolled out at the end of session without a lot of review from a lot of the stakeholders, judges, district attorneys, people that are really involved in the court system. But they're talking about perhaps bringing those maps out during this October session for a vote, something we're watching. I'd written a column about it for Carolina Journal a couple months ago. Actually, my column was cited during the legislative committee this week. So it's something that, you know, we would like to see. We think clearly, since these judicial districts have not been looked at for 60 years, that it needs to be done again. We need to be sure with the changes in demographics that, again, the judicial system is fair for all North Carolinians, but it needs to be done in a very thoughtful, very careful way.
There's also been a lot of analysis from you and others at the Locke Foundation about something called the recodification of the criminal code, and it's a really theoretical concept, but it has a lot of consequence for people.
Right. A little bit wonky at first blush. Donna, what this would do is it would take all of the criminal violations that are scattered all through the North Carolina statutes, but also embedded in a lot of the licensing boards, the occupational boards, and a lot of the agencies, there are criminal violations that are outlined in those. Our criminal code in North Carolina is a mess. It's difficult for attorneys to make sense of it, much less individuals. Just imagine, if you will, that you want to start a business and you want to make sure that you make the right investment, that you do things all according to the law. But everywhere you turn, there are barriers, and all of this stuff is embedded so deeply across our whole system, makes it very difficult to figure it out. So you're sort of left with a choice. Do you move forward with your business, doing the best you can, making those investments, or do you stop for fear that you might inadvertently, through no fault of your own, might get into some sort of legal problems, even criminal things posed against you, criminal violations. So it's a burden. It's also a real barrier to people starting their business, people starting businesses, proceeding with occupations, those kind of things. So what this would do, it just sets up a commission of experts in this area, and there are about 12 people. It would be under the supervision of the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court to go through all of these mounds of laws and statutes and rules and regulations, bring all of those criminal violations under one code, organize it, clean it up, then go back to the General Assembly with a clean slate, if you will, a clean closet of our criminal code and say, you know, here's what we've got. Then you can begin to go through that and look at, does this make sense? Do some, you know, does the Sentencing Commission need to make some changes? So this is the first step in a real cleanup of North Carolina's criminal code. Has significant ripple effects through lots of parts of our lives, through lots of parts of state government, through lots of parts of businesses, entrepreneurship. So it is a very, very important first step to do this. And this is something that has been, it is ripe for consideration in the October session. Representative Dennis Rydell has been a real leader in this. As I've spoken to legislators, I don't know of any opposition to this. We hope and believe that the time has come to tackle this, get it done, and then begin to also do the other reforms that will be possible when we know what is exactly in our criminal code.
Well, speaking of rules, there's also some speculation that state legislators will be looking at rules that have a financial impact. What are they going
right.
to do there?
This is something else. And again, the John Locke Foundation, our colleague John Sanders, has written exclusively and very thoroughly about this. What this would do is, in addition to laws being made by our elected officials, members of the General Assembly, there are also rules that are put into place by agencies, by bureaucrats across state government. Now, part of this makes sense in that as the General Assembly passes laws, in order to implement those laws, that some of the agencies would have the authority to make rules to make those laws go into effect. This is all good government. It's efficiency. We want that to happen. But what happens when a state agency imposes a rule that has significant financial cost, that would have a significant impact on a particular industry, on taxpayers, on the economy? If there's a rule that is put into place for, say, let's just say $100 million cost to the economy over 5 years, what this rule throttle legislation would do is it would send that rule back to the General Assembly and just say, hey, can you take a look at this? Is this worth the impact to the economy? What it does is, first of all, it's oversight, it's more transparent, and it also holds elected officials accountable for those rules that might have a significant impact on our economy, rather than an elected or an unelected, perhaps appointed bureaucrat buried deep in a state agency who is not accountable to the taxpayers, who in many cases are going to be absorbing that hit to the economy. This is something that just makes perfect sense to me. It is the next step in the regulatory and rules reforms that we've seen in the General Assembly. And again, this is eligible for consideration when the General Assembly comes back next week, and we're really hopeful that they're going to take a good hard look at this and pass it. The Senate has actually passed it. We're waiting on the House to take action on this.
Are we going to see legislators do anything with some potential overrides of Governor Cooper?
Could very well. There are four bills that the governor has vetoed that are ripe for a veto override. There's been discussion. Some of these things are controversial. Some of them, Donna, passed the General Assembly by a very slim vote. There is a higher threshold for bills that will have to be overridden by the governor. So there's some question of even if the votes are there to override these. There's also one bill that is sitting on the governor's desk for him to either sign or veto. He will have to do it, I believe, before this session begins in October. Could see another veto, which we would add to that list of bills to veto override. The thing in this latest one, House Bill 56, there's a provision in there that we were very much in favor of that repeals the plastic bag ban in Dare County along the northwestern coast of North Carolina, northeastern coast of North Carolina. And that's something we were very much in favor of, have written at the John Locke Foundation. So that's another one that we're watching very closely as they prepare for their session.
Becky, this will be several times now that the legislature has come back into a special session after the original session has actually gone home. So what does this say? They're supposed to be part-time legislators. Do we have that still?
Well, I think so. I mean, there's a couple extenuating circumstances with this. One is the redistricting that we've seen lawsuit after lawsuit, waiting for court decisions, waiting for three-judge panels to make decisions, that the General Assembly has to act on those. So that's part of why they've had this coming back. There's also been been a lot of question of why can't the General Assembly get their work done? Is it too much work for them to do? I think it's worth a reminder that at the beginning of session, we have a very long lag time of them sort of getting up to speed and really getting down to work. I don't know that we need a full-time legislature. I think the short-time legislature, if they'll do their work, will work just fine.
All right. Becky Gray, Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, Becky.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Many people argue that we should turn to science to help answer controversial political questions. But does science always yield the right answers? Our next guest is a scientist, and he's writing a book on the scientific method. He's also highlighting the differences between good science and bad science. Dr. John Stadden is professor of psychology and professor of biology and neurobiology emeritus at Duke University. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Mitch. Happy to be here.
So we often hear about this during political debates, this notion that, we should rely on scientists. We should do what the science tells us. You're a scientist. Does it make sense to always defer to science in these political debates?
Well, if it's good science, it makes total sense. I mean, if an engineer tells you the bridge is falling apart and you need to fix it, you should probably listen to him. But when it comes to less developed sciences, or to put it fairly, sciences that deal with more difficult subject matter, not so much. I mean, social science is to some degree an oxymoron. I mean, there's a lot of social science. I talk about some examples in the book where it makes massive claims, but when you look at exactly the science on which this is based, you find that they're baseless. So there's a lot of stuff like that. In the book, I also talk about something called the reproducibility crisis. The basic idea is if you think A causes B, then you should be able to produce A and get B every time or almost every time. Well, it's turning out that there are large areas of social science where this is simply not true. People try and do an experiment that's already been done, and it doesn't work. And if you look at the assumptions that underlie these studies, you begin to see why.
In chatting with the John Locke Foundation, I understand that one of your starting points is a well-publicized study that showed that the threats to racial status promote Tea Party support among white Americans. That was the actual name of a study. And you dissect this and tell us why the science is not necessarily what we might expect.
Well, I admit the title is catchy, isn't it? well, the problem is... Why don't you read that title again?
The title is Threats to Racial Status Promote Tea Party Support Among White Americans.
All right. Threats, status. On the website where this thing first appeared, they said this energizes, the racial threats energize the Tea Party and so on. A lot of people were already predisposed to believe in this. But if you look at exactly how they did it, basically what they did was have people tick boxes in answer to a whole bunch of questions. Now, one question you could ask is, why a whole bunch of questions? The only one they were interested in was the one about the Tea Party, but it was buried in this sort of distracting list of other questions. And what they found was that a small number of people who were racially threatened, that's their expression, a small number of the people who are racially threatened versus not racially threatened favored the Tea Party. In other words, there was a slight preponderance of people who were threatened who favored the Tea Party. Okay. Now, how were they threatened? How were they threatened? Well, they were threatened by being shown a picture of President Obama that had been artificially darkened. So the assumption was, not proof, the assumption was that if they saw a really dark President Obama, this would make them just leap into the arms of the Tea Party. What they found was that out of 255 people, 25 people said, yeah, we might be members of the Tea Party if they were shown the dark Obama, and 15 thought the other. So there's a difference in, look, 13 people out of 255 is the basis for their claim that racial threat, where was the threat, increases devotion to the Tea Party, and the Tea Party is therefore a racist organization. When you get into the study, you find that, first of all, the effect is not in any way reliable. In other words, it's highly unlikely if somebody repeated this study, they would get the same result. Second of all, the number of interpretations is very, very large. Why did they embed this question in a list of confusing questions? We don't really know. What expectations did the subjects have? Well, the subjects were trolled from the internet. It turns out they used something called Mechanical Turk to get people to volunteer for this, and they used other internet access. So they didn't really know a whole lot about who these people were, and so on and so on. So the point is, the study, if you look at its assumptions, is simply baseless. That there's absolutely no reason to believe this. But it's presented as if racial threat, which was not actually measured, is a cause, which is not actually demonstrated, of the Tea Party, a racist organization, which is also not proved. So, I mean, the whole thing is simply playing to the audience. That's my impression anyway.
We are speaking with Dr. John Stadden, professor emeritus at Duke University. You're a scientist. When you started in science, if someone had said, hey, this is going to be our study that we're going to use to show that A causes B, would they have been laughed out of the room and told, this isn't how you do science?
Well, it depends on what – I mean, I'm embarrassed almost to say that I have literally never used null hypothesis statistical testing in any paper that I've published. I didn't like the method, you know, many, many years ago when I was a student, and I think I've been proved justified. So my work has been done with single subjects. And at that time, there were group experiments of this sort that were done. They were generally accepted. They were less political. People were probably a little bit more critical then. But no, this kind of research has been going on forever. I will begin with a man called R.A. Fisher, who really invented all this stuff and was a very brilliant guy. And he did not make these kinds of mistakes, but the people who followed him made more and more and more, for reasons that I'll get into a little bit. And so the method fits a social need. And again, I'm going to talk about it. It fits a need to publish. I mean, these poor guys in universities, poor guys and ladies, they have to publish. If they don't publish, they don't get promoted, they don't get research grants, and they have to look for a job. So it's a really an imperative. The need to publish is very high. But if you look at some of the important work in the history of science, I mean, the obvious one to think of is Charles Darwin and evolution, right? How long did he work on this project before he actually published? Well, say, how about 20 years, right? He worked for 20 years to get the evidence for it. And he didn't publish until he was scooped by Alfred Russel Wallace. I mean, the stimulus from Wallace that got him to finally publish, because he wanted to get it really, really right. Almost no scientists now are allowed the leisure of doing that. Almost none. Almost none. They have to produce results 2 years, 4 years. Otherwise, they are out. They don't have a job. So the incentives in the current scientific environment, I think, are very, very bad, actually. They're very bad. And you can look at them and see why they're bad, you know, and someone could talk about the history and why, how did it. It started out much better than it is now, I would say. But now the pressure is so high, the probabilities of payoff so low, people pay their mortgage with their research grants. They have problems. They've got to get results. And one thing about this NHST method with its 5% significance guarantees your result. You can be doing absolutely nonsensical work, but if you do enough of it will be significant to get you a publication. And I think that's why it survives.
Well, it sounds like one reason that we should be very skeptical when we see something billed as science that attempts to tell us a political philosophy of the left or the right. That is the voice of Dr. John Stadden. He is a Duke University professor emeritus. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue. More visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read. A new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. Now, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal. We hold government accountable to you.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some lawmakers want to redraw election districts for judges across North Carolina. The idea is generating plenty of debate. Democratic Representative Marsha Morey is a former judge. She questioned Marion Warren of the Administrative Office of the Courts about the latest proposal.
Do you have any concerns about the fiscal responsibility of that, paying judges for lodging, paying judges for travel, and having availability of judges traveling almost 440 miles round trip, if it's Durham to Mandio?
As long as we're given the managerial flexibility to use the assignment system and the authority of the Chief Justice, we will do everything we can to minimize that impact, both fiscal and both on our human resources and the availability of commissioned judges.
Therefore, there would be no reason to reduce the number of divisions from 8 to 5 in the AOC's view?
That's almost rhetorical because that's a policy consideration. I have to work within the confines of what I'm given to work with.
Since Warren wouldn't take a position on the issue, Morey asked him what he had heard from others.
Have judges come to you, express their concerns from Superior Court, District Court, about this proposed HB 717?
Yes. I have Superior Court judges that, as a general rule, except in a couple of areas, have expressed to me that they would rather let this take its course. And as long as that there is an open and complete and a conversation, if you will, they're generally comfortable with that. I have had other Superior Court judges that were incredibly upset, believing that the franchise of the people in their county and or their district was being disrupted by what they called gerrymandering. I have had district court judges tell me they are quite pleased with these maps. I have had other district court judges irate and incensed. I think if you dig into that original 717 map, you'll find that there are winners and losers, and that some of the folks that consider themselves winners may share that they may say something that goes along the lines of this. Judge Warren, I'm good with that map. I just can't say anything about it. And then there's folks that consider themselves losers for a myriad of reasons. They call and say, why aren't you doing something about it?
Would it surprise you that I've gone and talked to at least 20 districts? I have not heard one district court judge be in favor of this redistricting.
It would not surprise me at all out of 272 district court judges. Like I said, there are winners and losers, and folks that have political careers, sometimes they will not share in a group what they will share on a one-on-one basis.
That's Marion Warren, head of the Administrative Office of the Courts. He's answering Representative Marsha Morey's questions about a plan to redraw state election districts for judges. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors, the recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Charlotte sits at center stage for one of the latest battles against state government overreach. A recent news conference in the Queen City highlighted a lawsuit. It involves a proposed school focusing on makeup. Justin Pearson is an attorney with the Arlington, Virginia-based law firm, the Institute for Justice.
Today we are here to talk about free speech. Specifically, we are here to talk about the First Amendment lawsuit that we filed this morning challenging North Carolina's ban on Yasna's right as an experienced makeup artist to teach makeup to students who would like to learn from her, like our other client, Julie.
Malad Imam is the attorney who will be leading the case against overly burdensome state regulations.
Yasna is an expert makeup artist here in Charlotte. She owns her own studio, she's licensed to practice makeup artistry, and she's even appeared on local television twice to share her expertise. Now she wants to teach others how to apply makeup like her at a makeup school. Unfortunately, North Carolina won't let her. North Carolina has no problem with Yasna applying makeup to someone, yet it has a problem with Yasna teaching others how to apply makeup. Last fall, when Yasna tried opening a makeup school, North Carolina's Board of Cosmetic Art Examiners came and told her she couldn't because she didn't have a license for the school. To get a license, she'd have to satisfy the board's curriculum and equipment requirements. For every hour Yasna spends talking about makeup, North Carolina wants her to spend as many as 5 hours teaching irrelevant material like hair removal and facials. North Carolina also wants her to spend more than $10,000 on unnecessary equipment like wax machines and facial machines, even though she doesn't need or want it. These requirements don't make any sense. It doesn't make sense forcing makeup schools to spend hundreds of hours teaching skills makeup artists won't use. Yasna's students, like Julie Goodall, just want to hear Yasna talk about makeup, but North Carolina wants them to pay for lessons in unrelated subjects.
Imam says the requirements are more than just bad public policy.
These requirements are also unconstitutional. Under the First Amendment, the government can't require a license just to teach something. And And that's why Yasna and Julie have teamed up with the Institute for Justice.
Yasna Bukvich-Bayani is the lead plaintiff in the case. She wants to open the makeup school, and she explained why.
I'm here because I believe I need to fight for my rights, and not just mine, but for everyone else. There is so many makeup artists, so many skilled industry that's overwhelmed with the makeup artistry, and people are just not able to work or teach or learn anything other than what they are forced to at the aesthetic or cosmetology school. So this is really important for me, for everyone that I know, and I believe that this is just a little overlooked, that we should definitely be able to separate it and get the right and be able to teach and learn makeup with each other without investing time and money and energy into something that doesn't even connect or relate to a subject.
Yasna answered questions from assembled reporters. Among them, why is this idea so important to her? Why teach these makeup skills to others?
Absolutely. Makeup industry, it's very rewarding industry. People are always happy. Women love to feel and look their great. It's something that you can do if you don't have a job, you can do it on the side. If you want to do it as a hobby, if you just want to learn it on your own, so there's no limits to it. And it's a very rewarding job.
Is there a market for a school that focuses solely on makeup without the additional skills that state government believes the school ought to teach?
We have so many interests and so many people that are wanting to learn, because the only way for you to learn here in the States is if you are attending aesthetic or a cosmetology school, which requires you to take about 600 hours, even though after you finish, you haven't learned anything about makeup. So there's a big lack of education on that part. And most talented freelance makeup artists have taught themselves. And we just have a ton of interest and need for that.
If people can give makeup tips on YouTube, why is state government stopping Yasna Bukvich from pursuing her school?
Absolutely. There is definitely a disconnect there. People are teaching makeup on YouTubes and videos and Snapchats and showing how to do everything. However, you're just not, for some reason, legally able to have a school, to have a proper school where you can teach in depth of what it takes for you to be a makeup artist.
How did Yasna react when she learned that the state would not allow her to set up her makeup school?
It was very disappointing. I was in the process of opening my school and had interest in students lined up, just about six within maybe a month. We had a huge amount of people interested, and then when the inspector came in and told us that we just can't do that, there's no way to go around it. The only thing I can do is open up a cosmetology school, which, if you know, that's doing hair, or aesthetic, which is doing facials. Neither one of them have anything to do with makeup artistry. So it was devastating, definitely.
So what would Yasna have to do to comply with state requirements?
There wouldn't be any additional hours. If I wanted to teach makeup, makeup is covered, and it's few hours within those 600 hours. So you do learn very basics in a cosmetology or aesthetic school, but it's not covered as much as it should be.
While Yasna might not need additional training herself, she would have to teach her students 5 hours of other material for every hour she devotes to the task at hand, makeup artistry. Prospective student Julie Goodall is the second client of the case. She says she wants to go beyond what she can find on social media.
I want to know the difference between pulling up YouTube and them teaching you how to put your eyeshadow on, whereas she can't even tell me right now, hey, this is where you put your eyeshadow and your mascara. And so, I mean, I just think it's ridiculous.
Does Goodall have time to go through hundreds of hours of training for skills she doesn't want?
No, I mean, I really could care less about how to extract, you know, stuff from your skin and, you know, how to flip your hair a different way and things like that. That's not what I'm interested in. I just want to learn about makeup and how to better apply it.
Why all this focus on makeup? Attorney Malad Imam addressed the question of whether there are larger issues involved.
You're absolutely right. This is bigger than makeup. We're filing this lawsuit to vindicate a principle that under the First Amendment, the government can't require a license just to teach something, including makeup artistry.
What are the constitutional issues that make this complaint worthy of a lawsuit?
The Constitution generally protects people's right to speak for a living. That's true whether they're authors, journalists, or teachers, including teachers in makeup artistry.
The Institute for Justice chooses cases focusing on constitutional rights. Why this one? Attorney Justin Pearson offered perspective.
The Institute for Justice is the national law firm for liberty. We are the nation's largest libertarian public interest law firm. What that means is that we don't sue for money, and we don't charge our clients anything. Instead, we provide pro bono legal representation to individuals whose constitutional rights have been violated. We have 7 offices around the nation, and our headquarters are in Arlington, Virginia. The Institute for Justice, which is often called IJ for short, has been extremely successful over the years. And one reason is because IJ made the decision early on to focus on 4 key areas of constitutional law. Those areas are free speech, property rights, economic liberty, and educational choice.
That's Justin Pearson, an attorney with the Institute for Justice. That group is working with the owner and a prospective student of a Charlotte School for Makeup Artistry. They're fighting state efforts to block that school. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The John Locke Foundation's Catherine Restrepo has written extensively about North Carolina's Certificate of Need Law, which forces hospitals and doctor groups to apply for and receive a state government permission slip before they can add new services or equipment, things like surgical beds, MRI machines, things like that. Well, the state has now determined that government officials should decide whether or not North Carolinians are given access to innovations and better services. And now, another real-world example here in North Carolina. Catherine joins us now to talk about what's happening. She, of course, is the Director of Healthcare Policy for the Locke Foundation. Catherine, welcome back.
Thank you.
We have 2 North Carolina hospitals. They both want to offer a special cancer treatment. Tell us the story.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, Duke Hospital and UNC, they both submit an application to either build a cancer treatment center for proton therapy, which is a special cancer treatment for tumors located in the back and spinal areas. And, you know, when you think about certificate of need, these laws were really enacted to promote and to make sure that there's equal amounts of healthcare resources and facilities across the state, while at the same time making sure that healthcare costs are contained and to reduce runaway healthcare costs that have been happening since the past 40 years. But in fact, it's actually denying patients from life-saving treatment like this scenario we're talking about now.
And it's really incredible because, just to emphasize this, there are 2 hospitals that say, look, we think that we can offer the care and the service to people who, obviously, if you have a tumor of that type, you're in a dire situation. Mm-hmm. They want to try to provide the care, but they can't just go ahead and do it until they apply for and receive permission. It just seems crazy,
yes.
Catherine.
Yes, it does seem crazy. And if you go back to the history of Certificate of Need, as I was mentioning earlier, there's all these runaway health care costs after the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965. And so it was originally a federal mandate. And so under the Nixon administration, states, in order to receive Medicare and Medicaid funds, they had to implement these Certificate of Need programs. So it's the centralized planning regime at the state levels that have to make sure that there can't be too many ambulatory surgery centers or too many hospitals or too many facilities offering treatment like proton therapy for cancer patients. And so that's why this law was enacted in the first place.
How is it that the state could possibly determine what they think the so-called, quote, need for medical services is? I mean, are they literally sitting around a table and saying, well, this sounds terrible, but we think that a certain number of people are going to be diagnosed with this type of cancer. A certain number of people will need heart surgery?
Well, the way they determine what is needed in certain areas of the state is that every year they take an inventory of all the facilities and certain types of health services. There's 25 total in North Carolina that are regulated under their Certificate of Need program, and based on population growth or projections in higher utilization of certain services, that's how they determine if there is in fact a need from more of a central planning viewpoint. However, I think it's better for markets or for hospitals themselves in their own communities to decide and make that business decision themselves whether it's worth the investment to build a new cancer treatment center or a new ambulatory surgery center or a new kidney dialysis center.
Catherine, this application process we're talking about, it's not just like one page and you turn it in and then tomorrow they give you a call, yes or no.
Right. Yeah, it's very lengthy and there's multiple steps. So first, you have to submit a letter of intent of the project that you desire, in this case, a cancer treatment center. And then the Department of Health and Human Services reviews it. That can take anywhere above 90 to 150 days. And then there's a public comment period. So the public comment period for the Duke and UNC cancer treatment center applications, that's going to be October 10th. So that's coming up at the Dorothy Dix hospital, the former psychiatric hospital. And so after the public comment period, then there's further review. And depending on whether the Department of Health and Human Services approves the application, I mean, you can even have a third party come in and deny that approval, and then that can go to the Office of Administrative Hearing and the Supreme Court of the North Carolina state.
So meantime, while all of this process goes on, not to mention the fact that it's incredibly costly for these applications to be put together, et cetera, you have people who are suffering who could potentially be helped by this special cancer treatment, and yet the facilities aren't there to help them.
Exactly. It's a serious situation. And if you think about it, certificate of need, it's no longer relevant because we're further transitioning. Hospitals are further transitioning from fee-for-service reimbursement for services to more of they're solidifying contracts with insurance companies where they're getting paid based on the value of the care that they deliver. So based on patient health outcomes or cost savings, that's how they're getting paid. So, you know, when we think about certificate of need trying to bring in healthcare costs and reduce higher utilization rates and fee-for-service healthcare claims that providers are submitting, that's no longer the case for specialty care like cancer treatment.
Now, there are states who have repealed this law. They no longer have this anti-competitive law on the books, but is there a reason that North Carolina continues to go forward with this?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's a protectionist policy. It's a protectionist law. Certain hospitals like it because if they have proton therapy or certain services, I mean, they like it because it allows them to prevent other competitors from acquiring those same types of facilities or services to compete against. So that's the battle right now. It's a protectionist policy, and it's denying it. I mean, patients are lost in the mix, and that's too often the case in the healthcare industry now, and that's just because of so many regulations and less choice in the marketplace.
It's interesting you term it as a battle, because it really is, but there are some victories that those of us who believe in free markets have made in this area.
Yes.
Tell us about some of the services that are exempted from the Certificate of Need law.
Sure. Well, back in 2005 and 2006, there was some Certificate of Need reform. So if doctors want to have their own colonoscopy units, they didn't have to go through the certificate of need process to do that. And so they're actually able, in these standalone procedure rooms or facilities, they're paid by Medicare on average 45 to 60% less than that same procedure being performed in a full hospital setting. And so this has been able to save the Medicare program over $200 million within 6 years. And that's just on one service that is no longer as heavily regulated compared to the 25 others that are.
What's so fascinating, I think, is that if legislators have determined that it is, quote, okay to exempt one particular area from mm-hmm. the Certificate of Need law, wouldn't it just make sense that they would exempt them all?
Yes, that would make perfect sense. But, you know, at the same time, any type of reform, any type of incremental, slow, motivational momentum movement towards full repeal is still applauded at this point in time.
Now, those who support Certificate of Need laws, and there are many people who do, and there are some legislators who do, and that's why it's a battle mm-hmm. In order to try to move forward in terms of freer markets and competition. But the supporters say that, look, if you get rid of this law, that it's going to somehow hurt rural hospitals and the people that mm-hmm. they serve. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that argument.
Right, and I would argue against that argument because if you think about it, there are so many other factors that are a Certificate of Need alone. If you got rid of Certificate of Need, there are so many other factors that are hurting rural hospitals. Rural hospitals a lot of times see a heavier caseload of Medicare and Medicaid patients, and we know that Medicare and Medicaid pays below market values or what private insurance companies pay them for certain services. So whether you have Certificate of Need or not, rural hospitals are still suffering. So if CON goes away, rural hospitals are still going to have problems, but they'll be able to compete. They'll be able to compete with larger hospital systems who, in many cases, actually win these applications over rural independent hospitals.
Catherine, is it a common occurrence that we have essentially two or maybe even more than two operators, whether it's a group of doctors or a hospital, who have to try to compete for these services?
Yes, some do get approved, but at the end of the day, it's not just the Certificate of Need law that's denying patients of care. It's the process itself that's denying patients from care.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.